word for these upcoming awards. Want to stop blushing with so much praise for our project. We are going with Alexandra Oshan to complete what we call the opening paper, which we would like to sort of start setting some of the questions that undoubtedly will come up during the call conference. But just to get everybody within this framework, we are going to start with some basic facts that turn out not to be so basic often about both Trubadour and courts. We started working in this project in 1216. In a project that originally had a much longer name in Catalan, but eventually we shortened to Trubadour and European Identity, the role of the Catalan court, which is mainly concerned with advancing our knowledge in about the reception and the circulation of Trubadours. Especially focused on the crown of Aragon, because that's what we what our interests were, but with issues that we think we go much beyond that. And our main concerns were courts and manuscripts as the two privileged vehicles, the main channels of troubadour circulation. While we were undertaking our research, especially a map of troubadour courts regarding the troubadours that are connected with the crown of Aragon, we started finding many questions that had not been either solved or satisfactorily solved. It was not a surprise, but it sort of convinced us that the idea of organizing a conference where the role of courts in troubadour culture and the role of troubadours in courts was explored from different points of view, so that we could really progress, not just discuss the things we were aware of, the issues, the unsolved issues, but maybe come up with new ones, or at least with new angles to look at them. So here we are. That's the reason why we decided to invite you all to this conference, and I have to say that at least maybe politely, but everybody seemed quite happy with the idea of creating dialogue between historians and specialists in literature, with a range of specialties within these two areas as well. So thank you all for agreeing to come here, to give your papers, to discuss them, and hopefully to, after 2 days, having come up with some better ideas about solving some of these issues. Just to, as I said, to start with something very basic, I would like to run you through a number of things that are well known, but sometimes have either some gaps, or I think they should be rethought completely. We know the names of 530 troubadours. Their standing works amount to 3,565 poems. I take the numbers from the BDT. Some of these are anonymous, but compared with other traditions, the index of anonymity is relatively low. Probably has always been attributed to the central role of the authors of the troubadours, both in the first person voice of the poetry and the central role as authors in the manuscript transmission. So this brings us some relevant points already. We know the names, but sometimes only the names of many, many authors. And this seems to be, even numerically, a vastly important cultural phenomenon. So we should be set to have lots of information about it, but this is not always the case. Also between 16 and 44 are women. The very disparity in the numbers just shows us how sometimes it's difficult to identify the names behind these authors, and also the fact that scholarship is not unbiased. In the case of women trovadors or the trovaides, it's sometimes the methodology or even the ideology of the researcher that gives us one number or another. In this case, it's especially clear that more efforts have been put into discuss the specificity of the literature of trovaides than to pinpoint their role as authors and as patrons within the troubadour system. So there's still, I think that everybody will agree with that, many unknown questions about the trovaides. Traditionally, we call troubadours only those poets composing in Occident within the 12th and the 13th century. Exact dates are always difficult to come by, so it might be a bit earlier. Seemingly, the troubadour tradition originated in a powerful court that already from the beginning brings the court into focus, that of William IX of Poitiers, and it gradually expanded through a network of the main courts in Occitanie, northern Italy, and Catalonia. We assume that poetry circulated within these networks following other types of contacts driven by family connections, politics, other factors of medieval life, of court life. But this is not very well researched in many questions. Also, why were noblemen and courts drawn to it? What justified the considerable investment both in effort and resources that was involved in listening to, composing, and paying for this brand of poetry? And did noblemen always have the considerable training involved in composing poetry? Or was it a two-track system with troubadours and troubadours more academically competent than others? These are questions that it's not the first time that I've asked, but you know, I don't think a global answer is still available. It is also difficult to find an ending point, as their influence, the influence of troubadours in the 14th century, is apparent. As a Catalan scholar, this is particularly relevant to me, as Francesc Feliu just evoked. But for the purposes of this conference, I would just, other than our own problems with the Catalan tradition, I would like only to point out that we start to know a whole lot more about the identity and the relationship with the court of the 14th and 15th century Catalan poets. So I think it's worth wondering whether this can retrospectively illuminate some of the unknown issues regarding earlier periods. For us, it inevitably informs our view, so it might be an idea to put this on the table and discuss it so that people outside Catalan studies can take advantage of this data, which in some cases has been recently proposed, and in our case, we can discard what's not applicable to earlier periods. Secular love is the main theme of troubadour poetry, but also the channel to convey courtly values. However, troubadours are also concerned with politics, morals, plenty of other topics. Maybe surprisingly, little religion, but other than that, a whole range of medieval life and interest. Their political poetry can range from very specific commentaries, attacks, to rather hermetic references. They certainly were involved in the main political events of their time. Sometimes in their compositions, others in real life. Beyond politics, many compositions, particularly debates, portray the court, its actors, the audience, and it sets the court as the milieu of creation. All these aspects should be, I think, valuable as historical data when accurately read. And that's one of the main calls to a collaboration between different types of scholars that have different expertise and also different ways of reading and interpreting the data. Trouvadour poetry defines itself as limited in scope to a court elite, but when we find indications of extraneous individuals that might have entered this world, what are we to make of it? It is usually assumed that Trouvadour poetry becomes available to, let's say, merchants, because some bidders characterize in this way some of the late Trouvadours. But what about the church? We know of a considerable number of Trouvadour clerics. Did they only act as Trouvadours when they were in a courtly environment? Or did Trouvadour activity take place, say, in monasteries? We interpret in a different way, by default, the way in which non-courtly sectors interact with Trouvadour poetry. Again, we know poetry to be part of the... in both examples, are we talking of circulation outside the court or describing the access of various states to court life? Again, we know poetry to be part of the aspirations of 14th and 15th Catalan newcomers to knighthood, sometimes from a family of merchants, the Marc family being a good example. But was this the case in earlier centuries? Could poetry be a means of social advancement, or is it a side product of court life among people already in the court? We assume a wide range of status for Trouvadours interacting in a sort of, to use a very anachronic term, in a classless way, according to what can be inferred, for example, again, in debate poetry. But is this reflective of their real relationship? And does the image of Trouvadours in debates always correspond to their real status? Many Trouvadours are noblemen. Others are difficult to identify. Sometimes they're called jongleur by other Trouvadours, by the bidders, even by chancery documents. But that is again problematic, because often in poetry and in scholarship, a clear-cut distinction between jongleur and Trouvadours has been assumed. Traveling from court to court is detected in poetry, sometimes in documents and in the bidders and clauses. Not much is known of Trouvadour roots, and individual trajectories are difficult to trace with accuracy. Also, what's the reason for this mobility? The position of Trouvadours in court? Their own status outside Trouvadour activity, whatever else they did in life? Or did they really wander looking for a picture as they portray themselves sometimes in poetry? This is also important to judge their poetry and the involvement of patrons. Are Trouvadours mercenaries, independent voices, partisan? All of this has been claimed in some instances. Maybe there is not a general answer, but I think it's worth rethinking, at least for each case. What did patrons gain by it, and how invested were they on the poetic results of patronage? Poetry, bidders, trousers, and documents are three, bidders, trousers as a pack, are three main sources to interpret historic details in Trouvadour poetry, and they all entail problems when using them. Poetry, obviously, is not by nature meant to be read literally, and often is very elliptic. It also involves interpretation of a poetic voice, a poetic persona, which are probably related, but not necessarily identical with the real author. This we know. But many historical details we associate with Trouvadours are provided by the early concern with their biography shown by the 13th century bidders and clauses. In many occasions, it's well known, they have been shown to be inexact. I don't think their aim is to provide accurate historical portraits in any case. Additionally, these commentaries on troubadour poetry are problematic in themselves. Are they really related, or mostly related, and I think that's what might be interesting in the context of this conference, to troubadour culture arriving to Italy, as it is often assumed since Maria Luisa Meneghetti's fundamental study? Did troubadours really represent an alien culture in Italy, where the social, cultural, historical changes that made their poetry hermetic to a new public? Because in that case, how do Vives and Santos clarify troubadour poetry for these newcomers? Documents are also problematic, as troubadours mainly seem to fall under the radar, under the documentary radar. For such an important phenomenon, with so many names, so many very, very important milieu, documents and chronicles infuriatingly refuse to give the whole side of the story. And that's why we're so reliant on what the wider context and the reconstructions historians can provide will tell us in order to direct or to validate our readings of these sources and eventually of troubadour poetry.
Well, after difficult and source elements with Miriam, the things we'd like to, the common culture we'd like us to have as a starting point, we thought it might be useful to define what a court was. Of course, after reading many articles and books, things you published, I think you all know what a court is, more or less. And the idea is just to sum up some idea, some points, so that we have the same ideas as a starting point. So as an emanation of aristocratic life and of the social organization, we might define the court. We might describe it first as a very hierarchical and heterogeneous gathering of men and women surrounding a powerful nobleman, a woman, a prince or a princess. It is therefore a very heterogeneous milieu of people who would serve the powerful but also take advantage of their proximity and of the privileges of their status. That is, court might be defined so as a moving micro-society composing various cycles, more or less numerous and more or less central in the political and cultural life of the Middle Ages. Well, here we will consider it as a social phenomenon. At first, and it's still the case at the beginning of the 12th century, when our troubadours appear, more or less, a court is daily composed of a lord, of his familia and of his household, his family, his servants, his companions and advisors, surrounded by the gatherings of mice, and of their own family, living close to the lords within the castle walls or on nearby. Let's say it was probably often a very modest gathering of people. It was probably often a very, very small cycle. At some point, when required, or when needed, but perhaps on a more daily than exceptional basis, some entertainers joined this micro-society, as well as the more significant vassals, which clearly allows us to define also the courts in the centuries of the Middle Ages, a gathering of people partly linked with feudal relationship, but partly only. Of course, this short definition doesn't totally match the princely courts, or those of the most significant lords from the 12th and 13th century, We were basically eating around and peripatetic. Traveling around their very extended lands was necessary for them from a governmental and military perspective, but also that was an art of living, which means that the court followed the prince's footstep, or the court met the prince wherever he was. Those princely courts still involved and gave some central functions to local lives and made rest from the dust. This expression is from Audrey Hutton, who is talking about the Anglo-Norman at the beginning of the 12th century. And let's say that courts were therefore not only aristocratic. In the context of this curialization, if I might say, of the society, which was observed in both the Plantagenet and Capetian world of the 12th century, but as well in the Occitan world, households were already permanent, more and more developed, and they played a central role within the courts. The household, that is the domus, hospitium, or hotel, should be understood as a group of people holding an office to perform domestic functions which answered the rural's daily needs, such as lodging, catering, provisioning, and stabling, but also, and that's important for us, some ceremonial and cultural needs. Also members, as opposed to courtesans, and I'll talk in a moment about them, also members were paid on a regular basis for their attendance at court. They received wages, riding tackle, clothing, and food, and sometimes some extraordinary presents, grants, material or political advantages. For the living, some of them depended totally on their lord's generosity. Some of them not, because they are properties, rights, or they are their own business. But they all were dependent on the prince or the lord's confidence and support. Over the 13th and 14th century, households turned to be more and more structured, populated, and bureaucratically run, but some household offices became merely honorific and took part of the logics of clientelism in the Orange Bastard feudalism context. Following Mark Twain's word, we could say that from the 12th century onwards, until the end of the Middle Ages, the household formed the backbone of the court. Then, that is, if the household structured the courts, they also took part of their very changing phase. Permanent reconfiguration is another of the court's major characteristics. At the end of the 12th century, in his famous comparison of royal courts with hell, Walter Map found it difficult to define what court was, and I won't quote this famous bit, but he already clearly insisted on its permanence changing and fertile aspect. From this point of view, the courtesans played also a major role in the courts. First, because they went back and forth. Second, because of the very heterogeneous social profile. This word, courtesans, which was not used like this in the Middle Ages, is nevertheless a group of great use to call the large group of people who lived permanently or not at court, the members of the ruler's entourage who joined the court on the lord's request, following the special calendar of court life, the judiciary calendar, religious festive or political one, for example, or who joined the court depending on their alliance and conflicts. They were mostly aristocratic vassals, as I earlier mentioned, but also rulers and neighbor princes, lay or clerical councillors, among whom some citizens, aristocrats or bourgeois, territorial officers visiting foreigners as well, and some artists. They performed different roles within the court society. And they also often performed several roles, a vassal, companion or chamberlain, and diplomatic emissary, clerk and court musician, poet and scribe. Coming back to the example of the courts of Tours in the long 12th century, we can point out the absence in their courts and political outrage of the territorial princes, that is, great regional vassal during the Grande Guerre Méridionale in Languedoc and Provence, depending on their alliance with the Duke of Aquitaine or the Count of Barcelona. This usual lack of great regional vassal prompt contrast with the presence next to the cars of the original barons, who were some medium aristocrats and vassals, among whom some several lords of the Roman body. Until General VI, at the very end of the century, whose reign seems to have introduced a great change in the cult entourage, Laurent Massé says he doesn't see any prelate taking part of their court, but in very limited times or circumstances. On the contrary, the moral aristocracy, that is the military lords and castle tenants and some of their milites castri, belong to the cult's court, as well as an increasing number of Roman aristocrats, and from the reign of Raymond V, many bourgeois. Some of the later appointed Vivier, for example, also took part of the court's daily life, some quite regularly. Generally, historians insist on the very administrative and bureaucratic term of the court's composing during the 13th century, and particularly from the second half. It's already clearly the case that for the King of Sicily, the Angevin princes, and for the kings of Ireland, who already from the second part of the 12th century had extended lands where those princes were for the last two really itinerant and governed on the roads and with the help of officers who joined them or belonged to the court. Then, for that kind of very powerful princes, court in the last centuries of the Middle Ages was still a place for compagnonnage and entertainment, but more and more officers and administrative servants, among whom many citizens, surrounded the princes and lords. As for the troubadours, the question is, when they were not princes and lords themselves, if we can take them as court members, permanently or not. If they were part of the groups of courtesans surrounding the princes and lord, or at some point, if they were considered as members of their familia or even household. We will come back to those difficult issues afterwards, but for now, just note that following many of your works, depending on the individuals, we can see that troubadours came from very different social backgrounds, where sometimes membres à part, apparently of the entourage, and sometimes taking part of the lord's familia. The few elements proving their attendance at court allow sometimes to distinguish court troubadour, if I may say so, from poets writing in favor or for some lords, but who cannot be considered as court member. Thus, many studies imply first that although various troubadours might be related to a special court, or at least a part of their life, it's usually impossible to see them as a social group. First, because of their very different origins, and not probably any example in mind, but also because of the very special position each of them had, depending on the time and context of their presence at court. Whatever their social background, their status, their geographical recruitment, their belonging or not to their households, troubadours shared with court members and their lords, or let's say various vernacular languages, a common culture, biblical and moral culture, as well as historical, political, poetical. They share also some aristocratic values, such as generosity, prodigality, redistribution, and courtesy. And this courtesy, it's at the same time quite a good behavior, good manners, and an art of distinction. And it developed in the medieval aristocratic courts, which meant that the court members should be tactful, discreet, elegant, and eloquent when needed, and while living the aristocratic way of life of the court. This aristocratic way of life meant that they would share banqueting, good and abundant meals, rich in luxuries, clothing, music, dancing, performances, and very good words and poems. And this culture, this common culture, these are very important elements to which might help us to define also what a living quote were, was. And it seems to me very important that we don't forget it for the late medieval courts, which were very focused on hierarchy, appearance, and consumption as a means to strengthen their political power. Anyway, all those elements converted the courts in a major center of patronage and in cultural models for the rest of the society. But because of the century, and that will be my last point, courts on top of cultural center tend to be more and more the hearth of political life and government of states, principality or even seigneury, court society was more and more assimilated to political society. And then being part of the court was therefore more than a simple privilege or opportunity. And in this context, we would like to learn more about, of course, the instrumental process and situation in the different courts of the Middle Ages, and we will raise some short questions.
We have a schedule, a debate after the newspaper, but there's no discussion. So what we're going to do, we need that also because we were not sure when we started, how long would the authorities welcome us for, and we didn't want to start the first real paper, Ellen's late. So after this paper, we can discuss, or we can just not discuss, because I'm sure there are questions that will go on. But we thought we would leave you with some of the questions that we think that are important, that are derived from what we just said. So just phrase them, formulate them, and just leave them there. If you have first reactions, that's fine, and otherwise maybe Ruth at the end of the conference will have the answer that we will have provided among all of us. And these are only some of the questions because we didn't really want to give you a whole list. So really what we'd like to know, and I think I speak here mostly for the people dealing and fighting the interpretation of troubadours, is what court dynamics, court evolution, regional variations can do to help us explaining the place of troubadours within the court as an institution. In layman's terms, what were they doing there? What could be the social status of troubadours, which surely has not a single answer, but I'm thinking especially of troubadours that we don't know to be noblemen. They might be, but we don't know. And especially those that seem to be professional troubadours, professionals of what? In this sense as well, do the alleged variation in their status and the democracy I referred to before, the way they, the highest member and the lowest member of the debates seem to interact as if there was no social discrepancy. Do this match what we know about courts? Does that have a place in the court dynamics? What does the term jongleur indicate when used in archival documents? Because that's the way that some people that we know or we suspect to be troubadours are referred to. Can we define the frontier between troubadour and jongleur in more apt terms than what we have inherited from the 19th, early 20th century authors? That's one block of questions. What major changes in 12th to 14th century the world of where the troubadours lived between the 12th and the 14th century might have explained the evolution in troubadour poetry, or conversely allow us to extrapolate our knowledge from later periods to earlier stages where there's less documents, we know less things for certain. For instance, can the interaction between courts, cities, monasteries tell us something about the circulation of culture or about the alien quality of troubadour literature in Italy? And I didn't mention it before, why it's not supposed to be so alien in the Crown of Aragon? What are the factors that allow us to make these assumptions, and when can we refine them, nuance them? Does the logic of networks, both the stability and the variability, help us draw the troubadour movements, know more about why they move, where they move? For instance, can we envisage a troubadour, or say a knight, going from one court to another where these courts are at war or at odds for some reason? Is that a possibility? Because usually we think of movement among political allies. If there's no alliance, troubadours can also travel and beat other people, other members of society, of the courtly society. In what range of occasions can we envisage finding troubadour activity, whatever the status of troubadours? Were they everyday occasions, occasional, regular, as in following a pattern, large or small gatherings? Can we aim at documenting this? Can we envisage troubadour interaction around legal court gatherings, parliamentary, church councils, embassies, all these other sorts of moments when there is social contact? That those are some of the questions that, as you will all, or at least some of you, recognize, sort of inspired the different sessions in this conference. But we still have some more from the other point of view, from the point of view of historians, learning something about the research from troubadour, what we know or what we can hope to learn about troubadours.
Well, as for the history, of course, if let you iterate a court where one disconnected from their social and historical background, I think court historians would like to learn more from the troubadours, for example, some elements to draw a clearer image of court's festive life, for example, and performance, as well as from a court etiquette. Another question was raised some days ago. It deals with the common culture of the court members, their capacity to understand troubadour poems, to understand their allusions to contemporary political and career life, but also to recognize literary quotations or allusions to other bits of poetry. As a historian of the court, I think I'd like to know if there was a minimal or an expected commitment from troubadours to justify their appointment. Can specialists perceive a different literary profile depending on the strong or, on the contrary, on the weak relationship between a troubadour and a special court? And last question. Do late troubadours from the 14th century, for example, benefit in the court from the same revalorization? Or their social status and image, the same revalorization at the painter's gate, for example? And can we call the troubadours artists then? That was my last question, but I think from hearing what she will say and the dialogues and the questions, I think we might both take lots of it and gain lots of knowledge of the conference, and I hope so.
Thank you.